Welcome to Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News. I'm Bob Beck.
And I'm Melody Edwards. Today on the show, Governor Matt Mead explains that while he proposed some budget cuts, there will not be deep cuts.
We're going to be able to do capital construction and some of the other important projects at community colleges, University of Wyoming, that we feel need to be done.
Wyoming has special responsibilities as the headwaters of the Colorado River. Things get confusing, though, when extreme drought takes its toll downstream.
It's very easy to be schizophrenic in the Colorado River Basin.
We'll hear about a new program to help Wyoming's low-income inventors.
And I was sitting around scratching my head trying to figure out, okay, I got two kids in college, you know, how am I gonna manage this?
And stories about distance education, refugees, and climate change denial. It's all coming up on Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News.
Support for Open Spaces podcast comes from the Hobbs School of Environment and Natural Resources at the University of Wyoming, uwyo.edu/haub.
Welcome to Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News. I'm Bob Beck.
And I'm Melody Edwards. This month, global leaders are gathered in Paris to make a plan to combat climate change. There's broad scientific consensus that climate change is real, serious, and caused by humans. But political consensus in this country has been elusive and clouded by doubt. Over the years, climate denial arguments have changed, but as Wyoming Public Radio's Stephanie Joyce reports, the results stayed the same. Blocking action on climate change.
As an energy reporter in Wyoming, the nation's largest coal-producing state, it's not uncommon for me to hear climate change denial.
For the last 18 years, we've had global cooling instead of global warming.
We have 186% of normal snowpack. That's global warming.
The climate's changing, absolutely. The real debate is what's causing it.
That was Wyoming State Representative Scott Klemm, U.S. Senator Mike Enzi, and State Senator Larry Hicks. As you can hear, there's not just one argument against acting on climate change. In fact, over the years, dozens and dozens have emerged. It can feel like a game of whack-a-mole, with new reasons to doubt popping up whenever old ones fall out of favor. Riley Dunlap is a sociologist at Oklahoma State University who studies climate change denial. I asked him, is there a pattern to the denial? His answer, sort of.
Overall, since the early days, there's been sort of four main themes, but they have evolved as the evidence evolves.
You've probably heard these arguments. The first one is the most simple. The Earth is not getting warmer.
There isn't any warming going on. There hasn't been. Nothing significant is happening.
There is no science that proves that carbon dioxide is anything more than inert gas.
That was Weather Channel founder John Coleman and North Dakota farmer Tracy Melmer. But flat-out denial of global warming has gotten more difficult in light of the growing evidence of rising temperatures. So if that argument doesn't work, there are others. Argument number two, it may be getting warmer, but it's not because of us.
The hoax is that there are people who are so arrogant that they think they have the power to change climate. Now, that's the hoax.
But of course I believe climate is changing. It's changing all the time.
That was Oklahoma Senator Jim Inhofe and Wyoming State Representative Marty Halverson. But if cutting humans out of the equation doesn't work, there's argument number three. What's so bad about a warming Earth anyway?
Some warming would actually be good for a lot of things and people.
There are lots of suggestions that more CO2 will be good for the world. We'll increase agricultural production.
That was conservative talk radio host Rush Limbaugh and physicist William Happer. Finally, there's argument number four, one I've been hearing more often. Maybe we are causing the planet to warm, but doing anything to stop it will be devastating to our way of life.
It seems that there is a significant cost to our economy, to our jobs, and to our own country's competitiveness.
It will make no difference at all, and yet we're destroying people's lives and livelihoods.
If you took oil, gas, and coal off the table and you still wanted the same amount of energy produced by wind turbines, you would have to have over 700,000 wind turbines in Wyoming. It would cover the entire state and part of Colorado. Now, I don't know how the endangered species feel about that,
That was U.S. Senator John Barrasso, Republican presidential candidate Carly Fiorina, and Wyoming Governor Matt Meade. That argument, argument number four, is a long way from simply denying the existence of climate change. But researcher Riley Dunlap says all these arguments have something in common.
All of these discursive moves, so to speak, are made with one firm, never-ending goal, and that is block action to limit carbon emissions.
Dunlap identifies lots of reasons why people don't want to act. Fear of government regulation, concern about the economic consequences, belief that God wouldn't allow catastrophic warming. And he says for all of those reasons, denial isn't going away anytime soon, but it may continue to evolve. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Stephanie Joyce.
Today, nearly 40% of all coal produced in the U.S. comes from Wyoming. In order to access that coal, companies use huge machines to move dirt out of the way. That means a lot of land, over 170,000 acres, is currently dug up by mining operations in the state. And reclaiming it, restoring it to what it once was, is expensive. As the health of the coal industry declines, the ability of coal companies to pay for future mine cleanup is in question. Our Inside Energy reporter Lee Patterson sat down with Todd Parfit, the director of the Wyoming Department of Environmental Quality, to talk about coal mine reclamation.
The main question about cleanup revolves around this thing called self-bonding. Under federal law, coal companies are required to put up financial assurances for reclamation up front before they ever start mining. But through self-bonding, companies are released from that obligation if they can pass a test of financial strength. In Wyoming, billions of dollars of future cleanup costs are self-bonded. At a recent Senate hearing in Washington, D.C., Janice Schneider, Assistant Secretary at the Department of the Interior, was questioned about mine reclamation costs. Reflecting on the overall downturn in the coal market, she had this to say.
We've seen some very serious issues develop in Wyoming recently with respect to self-bonding.
So when I met with Todd Parfit, I started by asking if he agreed.
Janice Schneider's response to that question I wouldn't totally agree with. I don't think there are serious issues.
But he does agree there could be some issues with future reclamation.
The issue is whether or not self-bonding is an appropriate mechanism to assure that. I think that's the question that's out there on everybody's mind. You have to take a look at those rules and make sure that they fit the circumstances of today. And that's important to do on any rule.
So what happened? How did we end up in a situation where billions of dollars in cleanup costs are not backed up with cash while coal companies are going bankrupt?
If we could predict what the market was going to do, absolutely, you know, you could have gotten a bit of a head start on this, but could you really have seen at the time when the coal production was at its peak?
The decline in demand for coal and the following decline in financial health of the country's largest coal companies has hit hard. One company in particular, bankrupt Alpha Natural Resources, is a big part of the reason why we're having this conversation. Wyoming recently reached an agreement with the company that prioritizes the repayment of 61 of its $411 million in outstanding reclamation costs. The fate of the rest will be decided in bankruptcy court.
We don't know where we're going to end up in the bankruptcy court if we get to a point where they don't come out of this with a restructured organization. And that's the whole point of the Chapter 11, is a reorganization. So there's no call on that money at this point in time. If they were to go into Chapter 7, to liquidation, that's the point in time that we would be engaged in terms of where do we come out? We would be arguing that we would be at the front of the line, as I'm sure many others will. I can't predict how the bankruptcy court proceedings will fall out, but certainly we'll be engaged to ensure the best possible outcome for the state of Wyoming.
Parfit was quick to point out a few times in our interview that throughout all of this, Alpha is still allowed to mine coal, which he sees as a good thing. The agreement, he said.
It allows the mine to continue to operate. Over 1,000 jobs associated with that mine are those two mines that are continued. Those individuals continue to be employed. The reclamation continues, but also there are revenues that come into the state that otherwise wouldn't be coming into the state. So there are a lot of factors here.
Considering the uncertainty surrounding Alpha's reclamation costs, I asked Parfit, should regulations be updated? Is the system flawed? He said he really didn't know if any changes need to be made to the Federal Surface Mining Control and Reclamation Act.
But I think it's probably a fair statement to say that, and we are looking internally anyway, at the regulations, so the rules around self-bonding, and whether or not we need to make changes, and if we need to make changes, what would those be?
Parfit said DEQ is also taking periodic looks at the financial status, quarterly snapshots, he called them, of self-bonded companies. In a state that relies so heavily on these companies for jobs and revenue, is there tension, I asked, between your responsibility as a regulator to make sure mines get cleaned up and your concern for the health of the industry?
As the director of the DEQ, I don't feel any tension or any pressure that what we're doing is anything beyond what we're charged with ensuring that the reclamation occurs, but that we do our job in a way that's mindful of our environment. You know, it's not our goal to shut anybody down.
So where do we go from here? What's next for Wyoming's self-bonding program?
One, we have to implement the laws that we have in the books today and make sure that we're diligent in doing that. Second, as we've discussed, the continuous review of our rules.
And when it comes to Alpha's $411 million in outstanding reclamation costs,
we have put the state in a very positive position with the settlement that we have with the super priority and the balance of the $411 million. I think that's the best possible scenario.
That was our Inside Energy reporter, Lee Patterson, speaking with Todd Parfit. He's the director of the Wyoming Department of Environmental Quality. Inside Energy is a public media collaboration focused on America's energy issues.
When we come back, we'll be joined by Governor Matt Mead, who will discuss his proposed 2-year budget. This is Open Spaces. Welcome back to Open Spaces. I'm Melody Edwards.
And I'm Bob Beck. With the Consensus Revenue Estimating Group saying that revenues are dropping, Governor Matt Mead announced his budget this week. While his budget reduces spending that will impact some, it does not feature the deep cuts some had feared. The governor is proposing to balance the budget by borrowing from reserves initially and paying it back with future income.
Unlike what we have done in the past, where we look at the CREG and we look at projected revenues and we base our budget entirely upon that, what we've done this time is we've looked at what we think needs to be funded with our standard budget and the exception request to the budget. And because we don't have the projections of revenue from CREG that we would like, what we're going to do to fund the exception requests is to borrow from the rainy day fund, and that will be repaid at the end of the biennium, at the end of 2 years, with the statutory diversion, which normally the statutory diversion goes to build the permanent investment fund. And rather than building that fund with the statutory diversion, we're going to use the statutory diversion and investment income that would go into the rainy day fund and investment income that would go into the strategic investment project account to repay the LSRA. So trying to state it as simply as possible, we're borrowing from the rainy day fund to fund this budget, part of this budget, and that will be repaid at the end of 2 years with statutory diversion and other investment income. And in fact, we think we can adequately repay the rainy day fund. In fact, there is a possibility that we could even build the rainy day fund. So even though we're in relatively lean times, we're going to come out with the rainy day fund, what it is today, maybe even a little bigger. And at the same time, because the constitutional requirement of the 1.5% diversion to the permanent savings account, that will continue to build. So when you think about states being in a tough time, we're going to be able to come out of this. We won't have built our rainy day fund. We will have built our permanent fund. And we're going to be able to do capital construction and some of the other important projects at community colleges, University of Wyoming, with roads that we feel need to be done.
So to even try and make this even simpler, what you're trying to do is make up for a lot of the shortfall with what you're seeing right now as robust investment income.
Yeah, we have robust investment income that we've built up. You know, we literally almost doubled the rainy day fund in the last 4 years. The statutory diversion, the reason we have to borrow the money is the statutory diversion money is not here yet. So we're taking money that we currently do have, which is in the rainy day fund, and paying with money that will come from the statutory diversion. So it's a short-term borrow from the rainy day fund that will be paid back.
You did also make some budget cuts and some reductions. Would you maybe explain to listeners who's probably going to get hit the hardest here?
I think when people look at this budget, they have to recognize there was two areas we had to address. First is we, in the current biennium, this fiscal year, which ends in June, we did not have sufficient funds to meet the current biennium. So we had to make cuts to even meet this fiscal year. Every agency looked hard and made some cuts to get us through this fiscal year. Then we took some of those cuts and applied them in the coming biennium, not all of them, and we've made cuts on the exception requests that have been made by the different agencies. So, for example, you'll be familiar with the University of Wyoming. We gave less than the university asked for, and but we tried to fund those things that we think we have momentum on that will be provide long-term value to the university and long-term return to the state.
Since you brought up the university, I should probably ask you about one discussion that is constantly ongoing on campus, and it has to do with athletics. You have some $8 million of matching money in for athletic competitiveness. You have some people there that would like the focus to be more on academic programs, maybe even in pay raises, that sort of thing. Why did you say, I'd rather put my money here as opposed to those other places?
Well, I don't think I said I'd rather. I think I said that is another area that I put money. I mean, if you look at just, you know, in terms of academic programs, we have we've moved forward on the engineering building, which will be a $100 million plus project. When you're looking at what we're trying to do within Science Initiative, which will be phase one, about $100 million, and phase two, about another $90 or $100 million. When you look at the pay raises that we gave the session before, we don't feel like it's an either-or approach, but I do feel like athletics is a part of our only university. It's a part that goes along with academics, and with the matching funds opportunity, I think it's not only to support athletics in and of itself, but I think to, you know, for the whole experience for the students that go there, for opportunities for recruiting and opportunities for alumni support of the university is important. And I have said it many times, I think when you think about what the legislature did last year, which I didn't necessarily recommend, $8 million just as a part payment on a swimming pool over there, I think all in all, $8 million for all of athletics is not comparatively a large number state.
Visiting with Governor Matt Mead, most of local government finally knows what you're going to do with them, and your proposal is about half, a little bit around half of what they got last time. For listeners that don't understand, a big chunk of their income comes from these exception requests, and you've been a strong supporter of theirs. This looks like this is going to have an impact across the state.
I think it's going to be tough. It is the single largest exception request in my budget, and we started lower than that, and I actually made cuts elsewhere to get them up to $90 million, but it's certainly not the level I would like to be at, and if something happens during the session and they get another $20 million or so, I certainly think it's appropriate. Because as you talk to county commissioners and city council and mayors, you know, the state's facing some difficult times right now, but it's often even more difficult at the local level.
What I hear from local government people is it's time to maybe go back to a situation where they have a set amount of money that got changed many years ago by the legislature. Would you support that?
It would depend on what the model is. I mean, it depends how far you go back. But any funding model that provides not only sufficient funding for local government, but also provides a predictability of funding, I think are key issues for local government. they cannot spend their money as efficiently as possible if they don't have predictability. You can't tear up half a road and then hope that the other half comes in. They need the predictability. So any model that would provide both the adequacy of funding and the predictability of it, I would support.
This is the first time I think I've noticed you taking a budget approach with the Medicaid expansion issue, talking about how, you know, there needs to be cuts in the Department of Health probably if we don't pass Medicaid. You think that's going to be what turns the corner?
Well, I don't know. I mean, it's being a little bit tongue-in-cheek here, but, you know, if it doesn't, you don't care about people not getting health care, if you don't care about our small hospitals in the way that you think Medicaid expansion could be a benefit to address those issues, maybe you will think that if we have expansion or don't have expansion, it makes a significant difference in terms of our general fund. Maybe that is the catalyst that caused some to say, well, maybe we shouldn't send this money to California for the next 2 years. Maybe we ought to take advantage of it for our citizens. And if you look at the economic analysis in terms of what those dollars would bring in terms of services, you know, it's in excess of $200 million outside of Medicaid expansion dollars. It's just, you know, the nurses and the physicians are economic drivers in and of themselves. And so the way we set it up is in the budget that JAC will look at is, you know, one way we can actually cut Department of Health by $9 million if we expand Medicaid. The other way, we got to, you know, pay about $26 million. So I tried to make it as stark as possible in terms of dollars that everybody understands the consequences of saying no, even though we fought it, we did the battle, and it's the law of land, we're still going to dip into our general fund and have our other taxpayer dollars go to some other state.
It sure seems, at least in the Senate in particular, that there's been a lot of confusion about what Medicaid expansion would mean to the Department of Health. There are people that think that it might actually mean the loss of programs if you expand Medicaid. Is there need to be, I guess, a clear conversation with some key folks and say, this is really what it does?
You know, I feel like we've had those conversations, and I will credit Director Forslund of the Department of Health. He has created more charts, more graphs, more narratives on the explanation of this in terms of what it means. And, you know, we had the big push last year, and the program that he had, I think he did a very good job explaining it in terms of how it would impact the Department of Health, how it would impact health care for our citizens. And we're trying to add to that this year by saying, in addition to that, by the way, in these short revenue times, it has a significant impact on our budget.
Governor Mead, always a pleasure. Thank you.
Thanks very much. Always glad to talk to you.
When we come back, Wyoming's congressional delegation is still trying to dump the Affordable Care Act, and we'll look at the issue of water. This is Open Spaces.
Welcome back to Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News. I'm Bob Beck.
And I'm Melody Edwards. Thursday night, the U.S. Senate voted to repeal so-called Obamacare. No, don't tune out. We know Republicans have done that dozens of times, but this is different. Or so they say. This repeal is expected to make it to President Obama's desk. And as Matt Laszlo reports from Washington, Wyoming's two senators both played a key role in the effort.
You may or may not be aware, but one of Wyoming's senators is a doctor. He hates Obamacare so much, he started a YouTube show solely focused on derailing the president's signature health care law.
Well, welcome to the Senate Doctor Show. I'm John Barrasso, an orthopedic surgeon from Casper, Wyoming, also a member of the United States Senate.
Barrasso and his former co-host, doctor and former Oklahoma Senator Tom Coburn, were unashamed about what the show was intended to do. They wanted to kill Obamacare. The show never took off. It got more than 2,000 views on the first episode, but the clunky production turned people off, and soon they were just getting hundreds of views, if that. In this early clip of the show, Barrasso basically asked for an army of social media warriors to come out and support their effort to kill the health law.
What we've done is had an opportunity for people to write, call, Twitter, Facebook us, all different ways. And we actually have a lot of questions. We're going to try to answer them.
It's not just on YouTube. Barrasso has also taken his anti-Obamacare rhetoric from the lo-fi world of the internet to the austere Senate floor. Back in 2010, he started storming the floor seemingly once a week to deliver an address dubbed a second opinion. That's right. For 5 years, he's been letting C-SPAN viewers and cable show hosts know he's a doctor who opposes the health law.
Mr. President, I come to the floor today, as I have done each week for over a month now, to give a doctor's second opinion about the health care bill that has now been signed into law. And I do this as somebody who has practiced medicine, taking care of families in Wyoming since 1983.
Barrasso saw some of the seeds he's thrown in the wind bear fruit. That's because the Senate passed a bill to repeal the Affordable Care Act, and it's either going to become law or, more likely, get vetoed by the president, which is expected. While Barrasso is seemingly the GOP's loudest voice railing against the health law, this latest effort relied on the brains of Wyoming Senior Senator Mike Enzi. He's the chairman of the Senate Budget Committee.
Well, it's a special procedure that comes under the budget, and so we have crafted a way to save people $1 trillion in taxes and get into place a better way to handle health care.
Enzi explains how the GOP got around the Democrats' filibuster to pass the bill.
There's a huge rule book that we have to follow, and then there are cabinets full of precedent that it all has to conform to, otherwise you lose the privilege. Privilege means that we can pass this with 51 votes. If we lose the privilege and take 60 in, it wouldn't be possible to get it done.
While Wyoming Republicans are cheering, Democrats are crying foul. Even though the Affordable Care Act was passed by Democrats with a 51-vote threshold, senior Delaware Democratic Senator Tom Carper says the GOP is merely playing politics with the issue.
Well, the Republicans like to feed their base, and I presume they think this is helpful in that regard. That's their decision. They have the right to offer the amendments. My hope is that we eventually reach an end to it.
But Wyoming Congresswoman Cynthia Lummis says it's more than that.
Well, he is going to veto it, but our constituents are so frustrated with us because we want to repeal Obamacare. We want to repeal as much of it as we can, and we are thwarted from getting a bill to the president's desk.
Though Lummis admits President Obama's veto will send a message to the Republican base.
We want this bill so our constituents see that A, Congress is working again, that the House and the Senate can function, that Republicans have made a difference by having a Republican majority in the Senate, even though it's a very slight majority.
Senator Barrasso doesn't care, since he's got his eyes on the 2016 election.
This is a clear distinction between what the president is proposing and what Republican candidates running for president will do. And this sends a message that we are committed to repealing this and to replacing it with patient-centered care.
All of Washington knows President Obama is going to win this round on Obamacare, but the fate of the health law seems to rest in the hands of voters and the 2016 election. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Matt Laszlo in Washington.
The West has been struggling with drought for a decade and a half, putting a serious strain on states along the Colorado River. Wyoming is in a special position since the Green River flowing from the Wind River Range is actually the main branch of the Colorado. And as Wyoming Public Radio's Melody Edwards reports, it is one reason Governor Mead wants to build 10 small reservoirs in the state in the next 10 years to save water for Wyoming's use before it flows away to other states.
The shadows of cottonwood trees grow long as the sun sets over Seedskiddy National Wildlife Refuge in southwestern Wyoming. A perfect time to spot wildlife on the Green River.
Oh, there's a swan.
Yeah, there's a trumpeter swan there.
Wow.
Window down here.
Refuge project leader Tom Kerner passes me a pair of binoculars.
Well, that's probably a single bird. And right in this wetland unit that we just drove by, there's three different pairs that nest in here.
He says in the next few weeks, over 300 trumpeter swans will arrive to winter here. That's because the river doesn't freeze up on this stretch of the Green River, thanks to the gush of water flowing off Fontenelle Dam just upstream.
It usually stays fairly ice-free down to about our headquarters site here, and then it'll freeze up below that all the way down to Flaming Gorge.
That flow could get even stronger in the future. One of the governor's plans is to finish Fontenelle Reservoir. Back in 1965, they only completed half the project. Mead's policy advisor, Nephi Cole, explains.
The armoring on Fontenelle does not extend down the full face of the dam. It only extends to the part where they have anticipated wave action. Because it's not fully utilized, you end up with what we call a dead pool in the bottom of the dam.
So right now, it's holding only 120,000 acre-feet of water for Wyoming's use, when it could hold almost triple that. Cole says spending the $10 million to cover the full face of the dam with armor would be worth the money, satisfying one of the governor's big goals, to use or store all the Colorado River water the state has a right to under the Colorado River Compact.
We have a right to use roughly 14% of the upper basin water on the Colorado system.
The state uses almost 600,000 acre-feet, mostly for irrigation in the Green River Basin. But still, almost 250,000 acre-feet of Wyoming's share of the river just washes downstream every year. That's two Fontenelle reservoirs just whoosh, downstream to Utah and Arizona.
You know, you look at a lot of states on the Colorado River system, and they're struggling to find more water. And in Wyoming, we actually have access to the water. We have the tools to be able to use the water if we wanted to, but we haven't necessarily figured out the best way for us to use it and what's the most, where's the highest bang for the buck.
And the law of the river is use it or lose it. So the governor wants to capture more of the Green River, not only in Fontenelle, but by building two brand new reservoirs on the river's tributaries. His 10 and 10 plan is estimated to cost somewhere around $350 million. Cole says some of that money has been set aside. Wyoming state engineer Pat Terrell says it's counterintuitive, but it is still a good time to build dams in the high country.
It's interesting these days. It's very easy to be schizophrenic in the Colorado River Basin.
Schizophrenic because the more the lower states suffer, the more the upper states are motivated to hoard their allotments.
And that's because at the same time that we know we have unused apportionment, we also are preparing for drought management and preparing for the day when maybe the Colorado does not quickly recover from the drought it's been in for 15 years.
Terrell says, yeah, the compact does allow Wyoming to make money diverting water to the upper basin states, like our thirsty neighbor Colorado with its fast-growing population. But as for quenching the thirst of drought-stricken states in the lower basin, no. Terrell says the compact does not allow upper states to divert to lower ones.
There's this notion that under the compact that what we have is wet water that we can put in a shopping bag and sell to Nevada. You can't do that under the law of the river. You're not given that water in a bag. You're given its use.
Terrell says Wyoming needs to be ready for coming droughts. And back at Seedskiddy National Wildlife Refuge, project leader Tom Kerner says in 2012, he saw personally what happens when only 3 inches of rain falls on these high plains wetlands.
Yeah, water in the desert is very important.
But if headwater states like Wyoming start stockpiling their share of the Colorado, it's not just Californians that'll suffer. The river's natural ecology could start to feel the heat, too. But we'll talk about that in an upcoming story with new ideas for protecting river ecology in times of drought when our series on the Green River continues. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Melody Edwards.
After it was discovered that some of the suspects involved in last month's terror attacks in Paris may have come to France as refugees, governors around the U.S. have announced that their states would not accept Syrian refugees until more security checks could be promised. Wyoming Governor Matt Mead was one of them, but as Wyoming Public Radio's Caroline Ballard reports, Wyoming still does not have a refugee resettlement program to bar Syrians from in the first place.
Refugee resettlement programs help screen and sponsor refugees, provide a stipend, orientation, and English classes for new arrivals. Wyoming is the only state without any kind of program like this. Susan Pritchett, an assistant professor at the University of Wyoming's Law School and the director of its International Human Rights Clinic, says because of that, the governor's statement refusing Syrian refugees doesn't have any real legal effect.
This sort of reaction, especially from the governor of Wyoming, a state that doesn't participate in this program, seemed to be more politically motivated than in relation to anything that's happening here in our state.
As far as anyone can tell, Wyoming has never even addressed the issue of refugees, so it would be tough to say what a resettlement program might look like. But Pritchett says it would be nothing like the current situation in Europe.
I mean, what's happening in Europe right now is a lot of unauthorized immigration due to the waves of refugees that are arriving by boat. Those people aren't coming to the shores of the United States.
When refugees do come to the United States, it's a long process with many layers of vetting. First, they apply to the State Department's Resettlement Support Center. If they're approved, they go through personal interviews, medical examinations, and background checks by multiple different government agencies before being settled in a state. Governor Mead's concern in accepting Syrian refugees is that Wyoming would be put at a higher risk for letting terrorists in. But Mead admits that without a refugee program at all, the state is flying blind.
I don't know who's coming into the state. I don't have a way to find out who's coming in the state.
So he's asked the Wyoming Humanities Council to look into refugee resettlement with panels and discussions that will address the issue.
And I think the Humanities Council, they're not advocates for or against, but I think they are a good group to say, let's at least inform ourselves as we make the decisions.
Shannon Smith, the executive director of the Humanities Council, says it's more important now than ever to move forward with talking about refugee resettlement.
If we can go down in history as having had these conversations rather than move very quickly or base 100% of our decisions on one set of information, then we will have failed like we did by interning 120,000 Japanese or some of the other decisions that we've come to regret.
Looking to history as a way to understand the present is a main focus of the Humanities Council's programming. And at least one Wyoming historian sees a bit of history repeating itself in the current political situation.
I do see parallels between the political demagoguery that's going on now with respect to the refugee question and what went on during and after World War I in particular.
Phil Roberts is a history professor at the University of Wyoming. He says Wyoming was wary of Jewish European refugees between the two world wars for fear of German spies. Wyoming was wary of Japanese Americans when they were interned at Heart Mountain. But Roberts is not convinced that looking at similar situations in the past will change how government acts, especially if people are afraid.
Well, oftentimes history isn't as good an indicator of what's going to happen in the present or the future as it is just a demonstration of human nature, and human nature is often hard to change.
The Wyoming Humanities Council will hope to address some of those fears and concerns when they start their panels in early 2016. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Caroline Ballard.
When we come back, we'll look at distance education and how the state is helping low-income inventors. This is Open Spaces. Welcome back to Open Spaces. I'm Melody Edwards.
And I'm Bob Beck. Americans love the guy in the garage inventor story, but invention is only one step. Successful inventors need to get legal protection, and that can be tough if you're working on your own. The average legal fees for just applying for a patent cost about $7,000, but now that cost won't be such a barrier for some inventors. As Wyoming Public Radio's Miles Bryan reports, low-income Wyoming inventors can now get free help with their applications.
On a snowy, cold day in the Denver suburbs, Glenn Vogel is tinkering in his laid-back garage workspace.
Welcome to the mess.
Vogel's a metalworker by trade. He lives part-time in Glendale, Wyoming. But for years, he's run a custom metalworking business here. A few years back, Vogel hit on a design for a new kind of high-end wine rack he calls the Element.
The tubing that we've got is slit along the length, and lighting is inserted into that so that you can't see the lighting and all the labels are lit.
Vogel poured all of his effort into the wine rack, which he figured could be his big idea. Building the thing went pretty smoothly, but then Vogel started looking into protecting his idea with a patent. That process can take a few years, and the quotes Vogel was getting from lawyers were pricey.
$25,000 to $30,000 to file the patent, get everything done. Yeah. And I was sitting around scratching my head trying to figure out, okay, I got two kids in college, you know, how am I gonna manage this?
That might have been the end of Vogel's big idea. But a friend told him about the patent pro bono program, then recently launched in Colorado. It pairs low-income inventors with patent lawyers who will help them with their application for free. Vogel qualified for the program, got the legal help, and now has a patent on the Element wine rack.
Your inventor, they know their invention, but they don't know the law or the process to file an application.
Jennifer Rothschild is the program administrator for the Patent Pro Bono program based in Denver. It started serving Wyoming inventors a few months ago. In the past few years, the Patent Pro Bono program has connected lawyers with about 90 regional inventors like Vogel, working on everything from a rifle scope to a mechanized fishing troller. Rothschild says while there are already pro bono legal services in the area, most of them focus on things like housing or family law.
There wasn't previous to this an ability for a patent lawyer who has been trained in a very specialized area of law to give their time in the area of law that they know.
The Denver program is one of about 20 that together cover inventors across the country. John Kirkpatrick runs these programs for the U.S. Patent Office.
Really, the important thing is giving people participation in the patent system where they wouldn't be participating otherwise. And if things are successful for them, then they actually shift over to becoming job creators in some cases.
But while it may be a lot easier to file a patent application these days, becoming a successful inventor is still as tough as ever.
Just because you have a patent doesn't necessarily mean that, you know, you'll have a new product. At the end of the day, it's just a piece of paper.
Devonna Douglas is the director of the University of Wyoming's Research Products Center. It protects intellectual property developed there. The center has filed more than 750 patents since the late 90s. Just 10% of those have been licensed for commercial use, and even less actually become products. Douglas says there is a valley of death between patent and product.
Most innovations, you know, they're a great idea, but to actually get to a commercial product that's available to the public, you know, somehow have to get through that valley of death, and it takes a lot of money and investment and time.
Glenn Vogel says he's done $30,000 in sales of the Element wine rack over the last year. But he says he won't be joining Steve Jobs in the garage inventor pantheon just yet.
Well, I'd love to put myself up at that level, but unfortunately, the Ferrari's a ways off.
But Vogel says he is planning to expand his manufacturing operation into a space a little bigger than his garage. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Miles Bryan.
Most parents of public school students in Wyoming can access all sorts of data on how their child's school is doing. But the public cannot see test scores or graduation rates for the state's two online learning providers. That lack of transparency is a problem that those providers and education advocates around the state would like to see fixed. In part two of our series on virtual education, Wyoming Public Radio's Aaron Schrank explains why that problem exists in the first place.
With about 600 students, Wyoming Virtual Academy, or WIVA, is the largest online learning program in the state. But the only physical trace of it is a nondescript three-person office building in Lusk.
This office here, we have our registrar, our compliance coordinator, and myself, the operations manager.
Kristen Stauffer points out a map of Wyoming hanging in the office lobby. It's dotted with pushpins, each representing a recent WIVA graduate.
So, I mean, we have kids in every part of Wyoming, really little towns and then some great big towns, so pretty much everywhere.
What people really want to know is not where these kids are from, but how they're doing in school. And that's not easy to track. WIVA's academic director, Nicole Tiley, says her students score above the state average on the ACT, but admits WIVA's graduation rates are far below average.
A lot of times, Wyoming Virtual Academy is a last resort for students, so it's hard to graduate students in 4 years when they come to us with juniors with 10 or 12 credits.
But the thing is, precise graduation rates for these students, PAWS scores, ACT results, none of that information is publicly available. The reason for that, Tiley says, is the same reason the program is headquartered here in Niobrara County.
So Wyoming Virtual Academy is not a school. We are a distance learning program in the Niobrara County School District. All of our students are enrolled in Niobrara County Elementary School, Middle School, or High School.
So WIVA's accountability data is lumped in with those schools. In recent years, Niobrara County School District's graduation rate was less than 50%.
That only tells part of the story.
Aaron Carr is the district's superintendent.
Our actual bricks and mortar graduation rate is in the mid-90% for the students of Niobrara County. However, WIVA students, even though they may live in Sheridan, Green River, Evanston, you name it, they're still a Niobrara County high school student.
Carr says WIVA attracts some students who are behind on credits, were unsuccessful in traditional schools, or are otherwise at risk for dropping out.
So that's a factor that does play into making us look like a failing school when we're not.
While both Carr and WIVA would love to see the data separated out for transparency's sake, Carr says he has a moral responsibility to students who need WIVA, no matter what it means for his district's performance data.
We're going to do the right thing. Let's say, for instance, we have to take a risk and know that that student may be a dropout, but they need WIVA. We're going to take them in, okay? We have to. We got into this field to help kids.
Wyoming Virtual Academy was the last resort for Patrick Flores. Patrick is diagnosed with autism. He says he wasn't getting the attention he needed at his Cheyenne Elementary School.
The teachers wouldn't, like, help me even if I had my hand up.
Patrick's mom, Esther Flores, says she finally pulled him out after several destructive episodes in his fourth grade classroom.
He had a lot of isolation, seclusion, and restraints. The last time he destroyed a classroom, they called me to pick him up. And when I arrived, there were four adults on top of him. We were told by the principal then that the next incident, they would call the police. I just said, well, he's not being educated right now. There has to be another option.
Patrick could not go back into a classroom then, so he's been a WIVA student ever since. Now the 14-year-old eighth grader learns at his own pace in a controlled environment. Esther says he's finally engaged with learning, but still catching up.
We're hoping he can graduate from WIVA with a diploma.
The only thing missing from Patrick's education right now is social interaction with classmates.
Recently, we did inquire about having him take one or two classes back in brick and mortar now that he's doing so much better.
Blending traditional and online learning appeals to more than just WIVA students. More than 90% of Wyoming educators surveyed by the Wyoming Department of Education said they'd like to see more brick and mortar students taking some classes online. We'll hear more about efforts to expand virtual learning in the next part of our series. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Aaron Schrank.
These reports are part of the American Graduate, Let's Make It Happen, a public media initiative to address the dropout crisis, supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
Thank you for listening to Open Spaces. If you missed part of our program or want to hear a segment again, you can find it on our website at wyomingpublicmedia.org. Just click on Open Spaces.
You can always hear the show if you sign up for our podcast either on that site or on iTunes. We'd appreciate if you would both rate and comment on the podcast. Anna Rader is our web editor. Open Spaces is a production of Wyoming Public Radio News.